Support for NPR podcasts comes from HBO, presenting The Wire. The final season premieres this Sunday at 9 p.m.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Does it seem to you like the bills for your cell phone, your credit card, your internet access, your rental car, your bank, and your hotel are loaded with fees, many of which are incomprehensible, like the regulatory cost recovery charge on my cell phone bill? According to my guest, Bob Sullivan, Americans are paying an average of 1,000 years in sneaky fees. He's written a new book about these hidden fees and how to protect yourself from fees you shouldn't be paying. The book is called Gotcha Capitalism. Sullivan also writes the Red Tape Chronicles for MSNBC.com. Bob Sullivan, welcome to Fresh Air. What do you mean by gotcha capitalism?
Well, every day when people open their bills or they turn on a television set or they get on an airplane or they check into a hotel, they pay a bill and they pay a price. But then there's often a second price, these aftercharges, these tack-on charges, and it's almost impossible to know what they are. And they come around a corner, a dark corner, it's a surprise, gotcha. And next thing you know, what was a $70 hotel is now a $100 hotel. What was a $39.99 cell phone bill is now a $72 cell phone bill. And it's nearly impossible to determine the real price of things. And companies are making a killing by confusing consumers this way.
Oh, that is so true. But what I don't understand is, are those fees, you know, like legitimate costs? And if they're legitimate, why aren't they in the thing that we sign up for, the price that we sign up for? And if they're not legitimate, like, what are they doing there?
Well, they run the full spectrum, I would say, from being an outright scam, frankly, to being a real price that probably just should be, an add-on to the price tag itself. But something really magical happened in the whole nature of pricing a few decades ago, which really came to fruition thanks to the internet, and that is companies realized that they could essentially trick us with low teaser prices and then sneak in these aftercharges after the fact. And they could separate out, they could do this in the name of separating out real cost of doing business. So the phone company, for example, essentially now has tack-on fees for real estate taxes, for the price of collecting federal taxes. Not only do they charge you federal taxes, they charge you extra for collecting them. And so instead of just charging you one price, and which is the standard for, imagine if you went to a deli and you paid $3 for a sandwich and 15 cents for the fact that they had to charge you 30 more cents for sales taxes. So they're breaking out these costs of doing business and isolating them essentially so that they can charge you more in the end.
Well, let's look at my cell phone bill. I was charged a federal universal service charge of $1.22, a state gross receipts surcharge of $2.21, and a regulatory cost recovery charge of 96 cents. I have no idea what any of that means. Do you?
I do, actually. The last one there, that 96-cent charge, that's the price they're charging you to collect the other taxes that you mentioned there.
So, oh, great.
it's literally sort of like if the cashier charged you extra for taking your money at the store. And, you know, when they break that out, essentially they can pump up their bottom line. So that money's going right to the cell phone company, even if it kind of sounds like it's a tax.
And the federal universal service charge?
Well, that's the money that's going to the schools and libraries of America, supposedly. It's helping make the internet and telephone service universal to everyone. It's another very controversial federal program because most schools now have internet access, and there are some real expensive programs that are being funded by that, which aren't necessarily what you might think. Helping little kids get internet access is a great idea. Helping resort communities in Hawaii get fiber optic access, which some of that money goes to pay for, is probably not what you were thinking when you paid your taxes on your cell phone bill.
And the state gross receipts surcharge?
That's basically a sales tax.
Okay.
Just with a funky name.
They couldn't have just said that.
That would make it easier. And I think, you know, all these little nits really irritate us day by day. And I like to think, you know, every month when I open my cell phone bills, my blood pressure goes up because I feel like I have to get into this defensive posture and scour everything. And so that's the sort of day-to-day problem of gotcha capitalism. But there's a larger problem here, which is I think most people just kind of surrender in the face of all of this confusion. And a confused consumer is a profitable consumer. It's much easier to make people pay extra and to have them lose a whole lot of money when they've kind of given up keeping track of what their real costs are.
Who has the time to do this, to keep track of all of this? There's barely enough time to pay the bill, let alone analyze things that are designed to be incomprehensible.
Yeah, it's true. And in fact, in the book, I have lots of examples of companies expressly setting out to confuse consumers and how they do that. And I think that that's a really important thing for people to understand.
Give us an example.
Well, AT&T in the latter part of the last decade actually did market research to figure out how to design an envelope and a notice that consumers would discard. And they actually sent out samples to people. They did a study, and they found that certain phrases or bolding certain words would convince people that they didn't have to read the notice that was sent, and so they'd throw it in the trash. And the act of throwing it in the trash was essentially legal consent to let AT&T remove consumers' rights to sue them. So it was a very momentous event for a consumer to essentially discard your right to file a lawsuit against AT&T.
So in order to retain the right to file a lawsuit, you had to actually read it, sign it, and return it.
You had to read it and object to it and of course, understand it. But the very top of the notice, it said, you know, you do not have to do anything. And, of course, everyone loves to hear that, so they threw the note out.
So that particular contract was voided by a court.
That's right, because there was a paper trail
that
showed that AT&T's intention was exactly that.
But you say that other companies have perfected the idea of designing mail that you throw away, not knowing that you're giving up your right to do something by throwing it away. So how has it been perfected?
It's been perfected by the fact that no one says this anymore, puts it in an email, or puts it in a memo. But I think we all sort of implicitly know that when we get one of those 16-page notices from our credit card company that's essentially printed on tissue paper and in type that's so small it's almost impossible to read, that no one ever intended for you to read that. And the proof is in the pudding, and the number of people who evoke their rights in those situations is infinitesimal.
And evoking your rights in that situation would be what? Objecting to the raise in interest that you've just been given by your credit card?
Sure. Some of these absurd notes that go out are exactly that. A credit card company will send you a note and it will say, we're raising your interest rate by 12% unless you object. Now, everyone would object to that notice if it were written in a certain way, right? But because very few people take the time to object to that, it seems clear that no one is actually reading it. And the whole sort of asterisk culture, I think, is really at play here. I mean, I have a story in the book of driving by a highway billboard that says, you know, free internet bill pay from a local bank, and there's a big asterisk on it, you know. And how many people can take the time to read an asterisk on a sign when you're going by at 50 miles an hour? Obviously, there's no intent to really communicate anything there. It's just to try to communicate as little as possible to get away with as much as possible.
What does the asterisk say on that billboard?
Oh, gosh. I had to actually pull over and get on top of my truck to read the very small type on the very bottom of the billboard. And after about a 10-minute episode, which irritated my passengers, I read the asterisk, which said, "See Banker for details."
If you're just joining us, my guest is Bob Sullivan. He's the author of the new book, Gotcha Capitalism, How Hidden Fees Rip You Off Every Day and What You Can Do About It. Getting back to cell phones often come with contracts, and you have to sign up for a year or longer. What's your advice on these contracts?
Contracts are really terrible because they prevent you from acting like a consumer would in a free market. Most contracts are now 2 years, and inevitably 6 or 7 months in, you find out maybe you've been transferred, there's construction near your office, the phone no longer works, maybe you lose the phone, there's a brand new phone, maybe the iPhone comes out and you want to buy a new phone. Contracts really hamstring you, and so however you can avoid them, you can avoid them perhaps with getting a prepaid phone or you can actually pay for the phone up front, which for most people is a very hard choice. But the shorter the term of the contract, the better. And again, the larger problem with these contracts is that when companies have millions of people as guaranteed consumers for a year or two, they have no incentive to improve their service. And that's one reason why, I mean, how many people do you know say, well, my phone works at home, but it doesn't work in the office, or it doesn't work along my commute, or they have to go outside to make a phone call. And in this day and age, that's pretty ridiculous.
So you recommend getting the shortest contract possible on your cell phone?
Yeah, not just in cell phones, in DSL service, cable TV. The contracts, especially now where services change so quickly, long-term contracts really are a bad idea.
Let's move on to cable and satellite TV fees and contracts to watch out for. Let's start with the fact that a lot of them have teaser rates. What do you have to look out for there?
The teaser rates on cable television in particular, I think, are really abominable. When you get ads that say $29.99 a month, there's often an asterisk, but almost never does it say what the real price is going to be when that teaser period is up. It's usually 6 months or a year, and there are a lot of folks who can kind of live 6 months at a time and continually get those discounted rates, but you have to keep calling to ask. But the thing that bothers me most is again, when you're trying to compare, and the real decision is, do I get this cable service, satellite TV, maybe something else? I defy anyone to actually sit down and write out, like a rational consumer would, what will the real price of this service be a year from now so I can actually compare it, because the prices are almost impossible to find.
Now, you recommend that you not rent DSL or cable modem equipment. Why not?
You can almost always buy equipment like that online at a deeply discounted rate. And so you want to disconnect the purchase of the hardware from the purchase of the service. You can usually get it, in the end, you can get it cheaper. But here's a much more sinister reason why you shouldn't rent equipment from your cable company or your phone company if you can avoid it. Because when you want to get out of the contract, that's another barrier to removing yourself. So if you have to actually return the cable box, you might not change your service when the time comes to it. And there are endless stories of cable companies losing the boxes when they're returned and charging $200 for them, some outrageous price. So it's just another hurdle to getting yourself, to making yourself one of those free actors in the economy, like I think is incredibly important now.
Now, what do you have to look out for in terms of internet access fees?
Well, the biggest problem with internet access is that it doesn't work right now in a lot of cases. I think it's improved a lot over the last 3 or 4 years, and we did a study in the book which shows that of all the hidden fees that people complain about, internet access actually ranks pretty low. But it's really common that people are paying for service that they're not getting. Most people have no idea what the real speed they're receiving at their house is. So you might be essentially paying for high bandwidth access, but getting not much better than dial-up service. There are lots of really great services online where you can test your speed. My favorite one is at speakeasy.net. It's right there on the homepage, and it takes about 15 seconds, and it'll tell you exactly the speed you're receiving. And you'll then find out if you're getting what you're paying for. The biggest scam of internet access is paying for service that you're not getting.
Gee, I didn't even realize that was a problem in a lot of places.
Everyone just sort of thinks it's their fault. And, of course, if you call for help, this is a company tactic across all industries. They do everything they can to blame you. It's your computer, it's your niece, it's spyware. It can be all those kinds of things. But if you think about plumbing, there can be a lot of reasons your toilet isn't working, but it's usually the pipe. And that's often the case with internet access as well.
You devote a lot of time in the book to travel and all the fees that you run into through hotels and rent-a-cars. And I want to ask you a rent-a-car question. When I'm on the road, and I have to rent a car for just like a day or two, and it's not long distances I'm traveling, but I absolutely need the car, there's always this like moment of paralysis at the rental car desk where I have to decide, am I going to buy the full tank and return it empty, or am I going to fill it up on the way back? And it's just like a losing situation, because if I buy the full tank and return it empty, I know I'm not going to really return it empty. I'm probably end up returning it half full. So I would have bought gas that I haven't used. But if I don't buy the full tank and I return it full, I might be in a real hurry for whatever reason to return the car and not have time to fill it up. And there might not be a gas station easily located to where the rental agency is, making it impossible to fill it up. So I'm just resigned to it being a lose-lose situation. What am I doing wrong here? How should I be thinking about this?
You are doing it exactly right. I mean, I think that is one of the classic situations in gotcha capitalism, where you are a captive consumer with no information in order to make a rational decision. And so you basically do the best you can, and either way, the company wins. So you're not doing anything wrong. I mean, what's happening there is you have a Hobson's choice, right? If you were to really play this out, what would you do? You might go on to Google and research gas stations near the rental car agency, so that you could plot out your plan, you know, which could be foiled. Like, let's say you don't realize you need to take a bus back to the airport, right? And that 15 minutes you take to fill up the tank makes you lose your flight, and now you've got to pay a change fee to the airline. So you really can't win. And I mean, my normal advice to people in that situation is to pay for the gas up front, because you're gambling. Either way, you're playing a rental car gas roulette here, right? And so, you know, I think the reality for most people is they show up at things late, and you know who you are. And so, you know, take the fixed expense that you can predict rather than taking the risk on the surprise expense later. I think that that's a pretty good bet, because the gas, for some reason, the price of gas doubles if you buy it later from the retail from the rental company than earlier. And so you're locking in a fixed cost there. For most people, I think that's a good idea. Of course, the right thing to do is to take the time to fill up the tank right before you get to the airport. But you, again, I think you have to know yourself and pick your poison.
Right. So cost effectively, if you could actually fill it up before you get to the airport, that's the way to go.
Yes, that's the cheapest thing to do. But again, this is kind of like the question of how many minutes do you get on your cell phone plan. If you're the kind of person who's going to check online right. every other day, God bless you, then get a cheap plan. But if you're not, I think it's smarter to pay a little extra and get a bulk plan so you never have one of those surprise $10,000 phone bills.
Any other things to watch out for when you're renting a car?
Oh, my gosh. You know, car rentals, some airports, the taxes and surcharges can be 50% off, 50% above the normal price. So it's really important for you to get the out-the-door price when you're comparison shopping. And there's a lot of other things to worry about when you're renting a car. The condition of the car when you pick it up. I know this sounds paranoid, but I'll often take a digital camera with me and take a few pictures of the car before I leave the lot so that there's no dispute when I arrive, when I return, especially if I see a scratch or anything on the car, so they don't try to get to sock me for the cost of fixing the car. And, you know, I think the most important thing of all is using the internet before you leave to compare the actual price that you're going to pay before you leave. And the last thing that you might check for, although this is really hard to do in some cases, you just can't get the information, is to find out what the hourly late fee is so that you can plan ahead for if, you know, it's harder to leave grandma's house than you expect and you're 3 or 4 hours late. Some car rental companies that might charge you $40 or $50 for that. Others, it's more like 8 or 9. So it's good to know that before you go into it.
What about buying the rent-a-car's insurance versus using your own?
Oh, here's another fear. This is like the paper plastic question, right? At the grocery store. And, you know, and I'd just like to point out in this conversation, we could go on like this forever, couldn't we?
Yes, we could.
All of these and again, there's, you know, I as a consumer affairs reporter, people are always asking me for the answer to these questions. And I like, and everyone wants the answer, but the questions are formed for us so that they're impossible. So, I mean, I'll give you some suggestions, but the truth is you lose either way. And now I've forgotten the question that you've asked.
Oh, well, do you take the company's insurance at the rental car agency?
Yeah. No, you don't take the insurance. Yeah, call your credit card company and make sure that you understand the coverage that your credit card company gives you. That's a phone call that's really worth making. And most credit card companies are actually very responsive and will answer the phone to a call like that. But it's almost never a good idea to take that insurance from the rental car company.
Why not?
Because it's overpriced and you are already covered. You're often already covered even by your own personal automobile insurance for most things. And your credit card will provide you with gap insurance. But I can only say that's true perhaps 90% of the time. So before you go out on a trip, just call and make sure that that's the case.
In keeping with our travel theme, you say once you get to your hotel, don't touch the minibar, don't touch the telephone. Why not?
Don't touch the minibar because not only are you charged now $3 or $4 for a bottle of water or a bag of chips, but at some hotels, like the Wynn Las Vegas Hotel, they figured out a way to charge you even for just looking at what's in the minibar. If you take out a bottle of pretzels or a candy bar from one of the minibars there and you have it in your hand for more than 60 seconds to look at it, maybe to look at the calories, you put it back in, they're going to charge you for it. So don't even touch. Don't even open the minibar. And as far as the telephone, some hotels now charge you even just to call the room next door. Hotel telephone revenue has gone down dramatically over the last 10 years because people have cell phones now, so no one needs to make those $9 a minute calls from their hotel rooms. And so hotels are continually figuring out ways to generate more revenue. So just a call to the neighbor next door can cost you a dollar or two. So don't use the telephone. Don't touch the minibar.
Here's something really irritating, as if everything we've been talking about hasn't already been irritating enough.
This whole conversation is like fingernail scratching, isn't it?
Well, bank fees are really driving me crazy. You basically have to buy your own money at the ATM machines now. And as you point out in your book, there's not only the constantly escalating fee that the ATM machine bank is charging you, then your home bank is charging you a fee on top of that that the machine isn't even going to tell you about.
If you're not a Bank of America customer and you go to Bank of America now, it'll probably cost you $5 to get $20, which is crazy. And what's additionally, perhaps even more crazy to me, is that when you ask for the money, the machine won't really tell you that it's going to cost you $5. It'll give you half the fee. It'll give you the Bank of America fee, which is $3. But for some reason, it cannot figure out how much U.S. Bank is going to charge you for that money as well, even though U.S. Bank is charging a fixed fee and has for a couple of years. And, of course, it can do all these wonderful things like check your PIN number and check your balance and all that sort of stuff, but it yet cannot figure out what the true price is.
So why is this happening? Look, I mean, a lot of banks are open fewer hours and with fewer tellers because they know we're getting our money and depositing our money through these ATM machines. So they're saving money on personnel, and yet every year they're charging us more money to use the ATM machines. Like, why is that happening?
Well, it's happening because they can. They're in the business of making as much money as they can, and at the moment, if there is federal regulation of these banks, I don't know where it is. And so as a result, they're just simply escalating. They're playing with dials on revenue charts. And the more that they can make, the better. The promise of ATM machines was that we would have access to our money all the time and we wouldn't have to go into banks and stand on lines. And for the most part, people like the convenience of ATMs. But we're saving the banks a tremendous amount of money by not going in and talking to a person. And for that privilege, they're charging us a lot of money.
Banks also have a lot of hidden fees that you write about.
Yeah, the bank fees are probably the worst of all here. The banks are making about a third of their revenues right now from fees. In fact, some banks make more money from fees than they do from interest, which should be shocking. I mean, banks are in the business of giving out loans and charging interest, and that's an important function for the economy. Charging fees from customers, for depositors, is not an important function of the economy. That's just a drag on the economy. And yet, the biggest offender of all, things like overdraft fees, are incredibly frustrating for consumers. And banks have figured out that now our checking accounts are not simple checking accounts anymore. We use them essentially as cash flow accounts. So you're constantly not only writing checks, but withdrawing cash, using debit cards to buy things, electronic transactions online, automatic bill pay. And while everyone says, well, it's your fault if you dip below a $0 balance or a $1,000 balance, if that's your minimum, it's really, really hard to keep track of what's in your account at any given time, since this money is moving in and out all the time. And each time you make a mistake, it's $35 or $40. Banks are making a killing by confusing people about how much is in their accounts. And as of now, there's just no stopping them.
Now, here's a fee that's really baffling to me. This happened to me once, but I don't know how often they do this, that in some places, if you pay a bill by phone, you'll be charged a fee for that.
Yeah, isn't that crazy? If your credit card company tells you that you only have another 24 hours to pay your bill, and they say, call up and pay us, they'll actually charge us $5 or $10 to make that payment over the phone for no reason at all. Obviously, you could make it in any other way for free. But it's just because, well, it's for two reasons, and one is really rather sinister. Who is it that's paying their bill by phone at the last minute? You know, these are the folks who can least afford to do it, and these are the folks who are under the most pressure. So when you're on the phone and the bank says, you know, if you don't pay this bill right now, all sorts of terrible things are going to happen to you. So people are intimidated into paying, not only paying their bill that way, but getting dinged this last extra dishonorable charge. And again, you know, there's no one stopping them, so why wouldn't they?
If you're just joining us, my guest is Bob Sullivan, and he's the author of the new book, Gotcha Capitalism, How Hidden Fees Rip You Off Every Day and What You Can Do About It. Why are all these hidden fees being hidden now? I mean, it seems like that particularly in the last 10 years or so that we've been seeing many more of these hidden fees than we used to. I mean, is that an exaggeration?
No, it's absolutely the case, and that's part of why I wrote the book. I'm a technology reporter, not a personal finance reporter. And the reason that hidden fees have become this raging industry that they have is because of technology. That's how I happened on the story, just writing about people's cell phone bills and cable television and internet access and why these things irritate people. Bait and switch has always existed in any economy. But what we have now is, instead of somebody trying to steal thousands of dollars from a few people at once, what we have are companies stealing a dollar or two from thousands of people all the time. And that adds up very quickly. They've perfected the amount they can ding us for one little bit at a time. It's usually about $10 a month. Most people won't complain about $8 or $9 extra dollars here or there, and they've figured out what that pain point is. And they've also refined their databases and figured out exactly how they can expense things and parse things out, as we discussed with cell phone bills and cellular phone bills. And so it's really the computers, these big giant smart supercomputers that all these companies have, that are constantly honing ways to get more and more pennies and nickels from us. And in the face of that information war, us consumers really don't stand a chance.
Why isn't there more regulation protecting us consumers?
I don't really know why there isn't any more regulation protecting us. But I do know this. Whether you're talking about bridges that are collapsing or levees that are collapsing or America's infrastructure in general, there isn't a lot of disagreement that there are all sorts of chinks in our armor here. And I looked back at the history of the Federal Trade Commission while I was working on this book, which is the federal agency that's chiefly ordained with protecting us, along with the Consumer Product Safety Commission and some other federal agencies. But the Federal Trade Commission would be the one that most people know about. And in 1979, the FTC had 1,700 full-time employees. Last year, the FTC had about 1,000 full-time employees. So it's nearly half the size. And during the intervening couple of decades, the FTC added to its list of things to do the internet, the do not call list, spam, identity theft. And by the way, the population is about 75 million larger. So the FTC has a far bigger jobs than it had in the late 1970s and early 1980s, and it's doing so with half the staff. There just aren't nearly enough people whose job it is to make sure that companies are being fair with us. And the end result, which I think is the biggest problem of all for consumers, is when you get a $500 cell phone bill, and it's because your cell phone company changed your plan and didn't inform you and didn't even send you anything in writing, which is legal and happens every day in this country, who do you turn to for help? How do you get justice? And the truth is, right now, there isn't any place to turn for justice, and that's because we haven't invested in the infrastructure, I think, for our bridges, for our cities, for our transportation, and in what I would call the infrastructure for our market economy, which is keeping a fair market. We aren't investing in that, and this is the result.
A lot of people would say, well, the market will straighten this out because the market straightens things out. But you're very skeptical of that.
I am, because, well, I think, first of all, I can just point at the way things are, and for all the evidence I really need that the market is not straightening this out. But what people don't understand about a free market is that it doesn't mean it's a free-for-all market. There are rules. I mean, think about when your family pulls out a board game, and what happens if you just start playing without reading the rules? Pretty quickly, somebody's throwing an eggnog at somebody else, right? Because if there's no rules, eventually things descend into chaos. And that's really what we have here. And the fundamental rule that's missing right now is, what do things cost? When you go to a cell phone store or a grocery store, why don't the price tags on those things mean anything? Why can you end up being charged much more than you think? And, you know, what's happened is we've basically thrown out all the rules, and as a result, we don't have a functioning market economy anymore. We have a broken economy, and we need a market fix for that, which involves setting rules.
Well, you point out in your book that now that a lot of companies charge these hidden fees, other companies have to charge them too to be competitive.
This is a very important point to me, because I don't want to sound like all companies are bad and all consumers are good, because we have all things on all spectrum of that. Obviously, some consumers try to cheat companies and vice versa. But here's what's important. I think there are lots of companies out there that would dearly love more regulation, that would really like to know that when they set a price for things, that all their competitors won't be able to cheat either. I have a story in the book about a hotel company that experimented with upfront pricing and tried to put on the internet the price consumers would pay when they left that morning after staying in the hotel. And what happened to that hotel? They were losing customers like crazy to their competitors who were lying about what the real price was. So they just couldn't afford to be honest. I think that's tragic. I think in our economy, we're losing our way if companies really can't afford to be fair with people. And there are lots of companies who, if given the opportunity, would really enjoy competing in a marketplace where everything was above board.
My guest is Bob Sullivan. He's the author of the new book, Gotcha Capitalism, How Hidden Fees Rip You Off Every Day and What You Can Do About It. Now, you're also an expert on internet fraud, but I want to share with you some really good news. I've been really lucky in the past few days. Within just a few days, I have just been honored by the internet. For example, the International Awareness Promotion Department of the BMW Auto Company informed me that my email address had been randomly selected as a star prize winner. That's worth 500,000 euros. And all I need to do is contact the claim office with my name, address, country, age, sex, occupation, phone number, and fax. Plus, I'm so lucky, Barrister Williams Moore Law Firm contacted me that the great philanthropist, the late David Rollins, made a random selection of individuals drawn from 250 countries whom he expects to continue in line with his selfless services to mankind. And I was chosen as one of those people. And all I need to do is give them my name, address, nationality, age, occupation, phone, fax, country of residence. What's going on here?
You didn't win the Spanish lottery, El Gordo?
No. Oh, God, I'm offended.
You probably are the only one. These are all just the very simple Nigerian scam that everyone's familiar with. But one thing that you need to understand about scam artists is that they don't sit still, unlike a lot of American companies. These guys are very innovative, and they are constantly honing their pitch. And the minute that they figure out that something works, they send it out to the whole world. And every story gets more and more elaborate. They keep layering stories on. And the point I like to make when I'm talking to people about internet scams is everyone knows when you get an email that says you have a long-lost relative in Kenya, that's a scam. And everyone laughs and says, isn't this silly? I would never fall for that. Well, I'm here to tell you, people fall for it all the time. I've talked to dozens and dozens of victims who've sent $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 overseas for things like this. Probably not as simple as the scams that you were just describing, but when they're just a little bit more complicated, people fall for them.
But these scams, they want to give me money. They're not asking
They want to give you
they
money.
They want to give sure, me well, money.
Let me give you an example of something that's just a little bit more refined than what you described. I have a friend who is a new owner of a bed and breakfast on the Jersey Shore, a beautiful place, and she recently got an email from someone from Africa, but a dignitary, who said that he was going to work for a six-month stint at UNICEF in New York City and needed a place to stay. And along came a check from UNICEF, drawn off what looked like a UNICEF bank account. Now, if you deposit that check, the money would have gone into her account because the bank would have cleared the check. And banks can actually unclear checks, if you will, discover that they're fraudulent for weeks later. So they can literally put the money into your account and then take the money back out because they don't actually do the fraud checking immediately. They just give you the money. Now, if you're a business owner and you get a check like that, that's a pretty good story. And again, it's a check that looks like it's from a big organization. The money actually goes into your account. So what the scam is, of course, is eventually the guy will call and say, I can't actually make it. Can you refund the money? Or can you refund half the money because I can only make it for half the time? So you send money back overseas. So I think it's really important when we talk about internet scams that, well, a lot of them are funny and they sound really unbelievable. The truth is, with just a little bit more tweaking, they're very believable and anybody can fall for them.
Yeah, and with these, with the ones that I read, I mean, they're not asking for my credit card number or my social security
right.
number. And those are two of the big indicators that someone's trying to steal your identity or somehow falsely get access to your bank account or your credit card. They're not asking for that.
No, and they've figured out now, enough people like me have written stories that warn people, if someone asks for your credit card number up front, you don't give it to them. So they just take it one step removed. That's a way of creating what sometimes is called a sucker's list in the business. They send out 10 million of those notes, and you know what, 95 people write back because they say, you know what, it's probably not real, but what the heck? What's the risk? They didn't ask for anything personal. And the exchange might then go on for a couple of weeks before they actually pop the question. And by then, you know, they've probably worked on your defenses a bit. There are amazing scams involving online dating sites that are very parallel to what you're describing, where people have whole relationships. I've seen people drag this on for 6 months. A guy overseas who romances a woman even sends her flowers and candy, of course purchased with stolen credit cards, and then finally asks for a little bit of money to travel overseas to go see her. So, again, that's just the same scam, the same core scam, but just drawn out a little bit more elaborately.
I have a feeling that since I got about four of these within 4 days of each other, they're all from, like, the same list. You
yes.
know, that these are all, like, the same person, or, like, all of these four groups that were trying to, you know, make me these, quote, offers, got my name off the same list at the same time.
That's very likely. And so the question, fundamental question is there, how do people find your email address?
Yeah.
And there's lots of ways they do that. The most common way they do is by what they call scraping the internet. They just send out these spiders that find every email address imaginable on any kind of a web page anywhere. And I have a feeling that you're a fairly prominent public figure and there's probably an email address for you somewhere. But if this were a private email address, then you might start to ask yourself, you know, if I've only shared this with some friends and maybe a couple of companies, are those companies sharing the information? And I'm here to give you the sad news that companies share a lot of information that they take about us, even when their privacy policies say that they won't and their public relations people say that they don't. Companies frequently sell our information. And when they do, we can't keep track of where it ends up anymore. So it might go from a legitimate company to maybe a not-so-legitimate company and then end up in the hands of a scammer.
Well, Bob Sullivan, it's been great to talk with you. Thanks for all your explanations and analysis and advice. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you for the opportunity. I really care a lot about this subject. I think people should be treated fairly, and we're not doing that right now.
Bob Sullivan is the author of the new book, Gotcha Capitalism. He writes the Red Tape Chronicles for MSNBC.com. All the celebration in the media that occurred around the 40th anniversary of the Summer of Love, there was nobody really questioning whether the San Francisco sound that was so integral to the Summer of Love even existed. The answer has arrived with Love is the Song We Sing, a four-disc set from Rhino Records, compiled by Alec Palau, and packaged as a hardcover book with a gallery of photographs by Jim Marshall, Herb Green, and others. Rock historian Ed Ward takes a look and a listen.
Like many another part of the country, the San Francisco Bay Area in 1965 had its folkies, its Beatles and Stones-inspired bands, and its surf musicians. A lot of them got played on local radio, too, which is something else that wasn't too unusual in those days. But starting in late 1965, it appeared that a change was coming, with crowds showing up to dance, itself illegal, at large dance concerts promoted by local bohemians, featuring some very odd bands.
Woo-hoo, I think I'm going to sigh. Woo-hoo, I think I'm going to cry. Oh, baby, I just know I'm going to die. Woo-hoo, about the things you do. Woo-hoo, that make me feel so blue. Oh, baby, don't you know that I love you.
The Charlatans were a well-dressed quintet who looked like they'd stepped out of an Edwardian engraving onto the stage. Having spent the summer getting tight, in more ways than one, at the Red Dog Saloon in Virginia City, Nevada, they were now ready to take the stage in their hometown with a unique blend of folk rock and improvisation. Nor were they alone. Another band that assembled around Marty Balin, a former artist and dancer who decided to try an electric folk vision of his own and named his band Blind Lemon Jefferson Airplane, which was too long, so they settled on just the last two words.
It's no It's no secret when I say my love is
Jefferson Airplane had one advantage over the charlatans, though, a record contract with RCA, which was undoubtedly trying to match the top 10 success of another San Francisco folk rock act, We Five.
But I woke up this morning, and you were on my mind.
Five faded pretty quickly, but early in 1966, when dances started being held regularly at the Fillmore Auditorium in San Francisco, a bewildering number of bands started showing up looking for bookings. Not all of them were from San Francisco, though.
Foolish woman, left it, tears in my eyes.
The Oxford Circle, for instance, were from Davis, in the suburbs of Sacramento, and although they were never part of the official story, they appeared at both the Fillmore and Avalon ballrooms frequently and were huge favorites with the crowds. So were plenty of other bands from the city's outskirts, like the Frumious Bandersnatch from Diablo Valley, Quicksilver Messenger Service from Mill Valley, and the Warlocks from Palo Alto, who changed their name to the Grateful Dead. In El Cerrito, north of Berkeley, was another band that would never play the ballrooms. Originally the Gollywogs, they became Creedence Clearwater Revival. Very few of these bands sounded like each other. The Fillmore and Avalon, with rival promoters Bill Graham and Chet Helms, presented three bands per show most of the time, and although some of them came from Texas and Seattle, a lot of them were local. This fact wasn't lost on the record companies, who were mostly based in Los Angeles, and soon not only Jefferson Airplane, but also the Grateful Dead, Quicksilver Messenger Service, and Moby Grape had major label contracts. Some of the biggest hopes, though, were tied to a group who came from all over, their lead singer from Port Arthur, Texas.
What don't all-
In a way, Big Brother and the Holding Company epitomized the rise and fall of so many of the ballroom bands. After one album on a Chicago label, they signed for big bucks with Columbia, made one haphazard album for them, and then lead singer Janis Joplin was enticed away to go solo, but she never really found success. Of course, a lot of bands never even got that far, and it's amazing, listening to this collection and looking at the gallery of contemporary portraits it contains, to contemplate just how much talent came and went in this place and time, leaving behind nothing but some very odd sounds on a piece of plastic.
Ed Ward lives in Berlin. The music he played is from the new Rhino box set, Love is the Song We Sing.